my name is Joyce. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety is April 24th, 2005. I have a sponsor. I'm in town to my home group, and I sponsor other women. And I'm definitely grateful to be here. It's definitely a privilege to speak at any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I guess I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I try to do today. And I was born and raised in Jersey City, New Jersey, and I thought that that was my biggest problem. I thought that was the root of my troubles, you know. And I grew up in a family that drank a lot. You know, alcohol was around all the time. I grew up in a home where, I mean, people were drunk and violent, and from a very young age, I knew that alcohol was bad. You know, I had that impression. I wanted to be more in the likeness of my mother, who went to church, who prayed, you know, who hardly swore. And I knew I didn't want to be like the men in my family. But I could tell you that also from that very young age, like what a lot of people share from the podium, I mean, I felt feelings of difference. You know, I definitely grew up, and my earliest memories were of discomfort and not feeling a part of. And I'm a first generation American, and I come from a Filipino family, and I had, I mean, dozens of cousins, and there were always family gatherings and parties and things like that. And even with my own flesh and blood, I didn't feel connected. You know, I just always felt, I couldn't articulate that, you know, and people would say, what's wrong with Joyce? What's wrong with you? I would just say, I felt weird, or, I don't want to be around anyone. And I just remember being paralyzed with what I know is self-centered fear. You know, and I just remember being in kindergarten and the back of my neck hurting so bad because I could not raise my head to look people in the face, you know, where it felt like I didn't understand why people just seemed to get along, play with one another so much easier, you know. And that may mean nothing, but for me, I just know that I suffer from a spiritual malady, you know, and that I always have. And my sponsor described that to me is that I'm disconnected from you guys, and I'm disconnected from God. And I feel this loneliness that no one, you know, other than another alcoholic, can relate to. So when we moved to the suburbs, I thought that was going to fix things. I thought it was the city that was a problem. And the same deal. I went to school, and still that complete separation. And I took my first drink the summer of fifth grade, so I was about 10 years old, and I was good and ready, you know. And I don't know what kind of problems a 10-year-old has, but I'm telling you that I felt very pressurized to the extreme, you know. And I relate to speakers that say that if they didn't find alcohol, they would have took their life a long time ago. Because that night, I mean, I was good and ready. I needed release. And what happened was, I had my first love, you know, my first obsession was this little boy named Jason, and I mean, I stalked this boy for 3 years. I mean, a real obsession, you know what I mean, completely consumed me. I mean, I'm talking about like carving his name in my arm. I mean, like that kind of craziness. So I finally got this boy and his, you know, best friend. They're really popular kids, and I mean, I'm terribly awkward at this point. And they come over with this other popular girl, and I'm thinking, like, this is my ticket in, you know, like, this is my time to shine and really, you know, be popular and be liked. And they came inside, and I mean, I remember this day like it was yesterday. I don't remember what the first time I drank Coke was. I don't remember the first time I drank milk. I mean, but I remember my first drunk like it was yesterday, because of the effect that it gave me. I invited them in because I had a fully stocked bar in my dad's house, and I mean, we had tons and tons of alcohol. I mean, it was easy all the time to drink. And we went down there, and I poured some Johnny Walker Black Label, you know, which soon later became my choice of drink. And I mean, I remember shaking and stuttering and just being like, I mean, a lot of headiness, you know, trying to rehearse what I'm going to say, you know, didn't know where I'm going to put my hands. I mean, that kind of self-centeredness. And what happened was I put a couple of these Johnny Walkers in me, and all of a sudden I just go, you know, and all of a sudden my perception of the world around me changes, you know, and all of a sudden I'm standing a little taller, you know, the voices in my head quiet down, my hands stop shaking, and I feel absolute release. And I thought that, yes, you know, this is why people drink, for this. you know, because it was like I did not feel any separation from that point. I felt like we were good old buddies. And the thing with me is I put a little more in me because that phenomenon, I started having that phenomenon of craving. You know, it felt good, so I wanted more. And it felt like the more I put in me, the bigger my ego got. You know, and after a couple of those, I wasn't even interested in this guy that I was stalking for 3 years. I kicked him out of my house. It was just me and Johnny Walker, you know. And then that's truly the story of my drinking, you know, that I had such a profound effect from alcohol that it became paramount to anyone else, everything, you know, any hope, goal, ambition, person, you know, the feeling that I got from alcohol just became the most important thing to me. And I remember making a clear decision that night that I had to do this as often as possible. You know, and the next couple of years, I mean, that's what I did. I we had so much liquor in my house, no one noticed that I was taking water bottles at a time or even bottles at a time. I mean, no one noticed, and I was able to bring it to school. I mean, it was just, it didn't make sense to me why everyone wasn't doing this. It just made everything a better time, you know. And by the time I was in seventh grade, word had gotten around that I had this problem, you know, and there was a clear distinction. I mean, because at that age, there are some kids that drink, right? But they're drinking like wine coolers and, you know, just playing around and being social with one another. But there was something very different with the way that I was drinking. You know, where we would go out to these field trips and everyone would have these like fun, fruity drinks, and I was just like my face to the bottle, you know, because I was, and it didn't matter. It didn't matter if there were. Was there another person around me or a group of people? You know, there were times when I would just completely separate myself from the group of people because I felt like I wouldn't get in trouble that way. You know, that it was like less of a hassle if I just drank alone. And I didn't realize that this is not normal thinking, you know, that this wasn't normal drinking or social drinking. So by that point, I was being reported to you know, principals and teachers at school, and I was sent to substance abuse counseling in seventh grade. And this was my first kind of consequence, you know, because this was the first time that someone wanted to talk to me about my drinking. And I was baffled, you know, because when I was young, another thing other than the effect of alcohol that I loved was approval. You know, I would do anything for a good pat on the back, you know, and a lot of people say that alcohol gave me that satisfaction, like a job well done without having to do anything, you know. But there were other times I got involved in the church and school activities. I mean, just anything to win approval and acceptance. You know, I became very active. So when I got called down to the office, I thought I was getting another award or being asked to be involved in something else, you know. And it wasn't. You know, there was this woman with her yellow pad, and she had glasses, and she sat me down, and I was very confused. I didn't realize what was happening. She just started asking me a series of questions. Like, well, Joyce, do you drink by yourself? And I didn't know that there's anything wrong with that, so I was like, yeah, once in a while. You know, and then all of a sudden she starts writing something down. She has this grim look on her face, and then I was like, no. I mean, it was just one time. I thought my friends were coming over. I mean, I didn't even realize it was alcohol. You know, I would change my story. You know, and that was the first day that I learned I had to change my story. It was the first day that I had to learn I had to give these people some lip service to get off my back. Because I knew from the way that she looked, her disposition, that she was judging me. You know, that she didn't understand why I drank the way I did. I mean, she was asking these very stupid questions like, well, why do you drink? You know, and I was like, I don't know, you know. And she would just keep digging and digging until I had to give her something. You know, my dad, you know, my mom. And I would just give them whatever they wanted to hear until after that hour-long, two-hour-long session, I would convince them that I was fine, that this was just a phase, that I was going to turn things around. I would even sometimes give them some tears of sincerity, you know. And that was, I mean, that was the story of my drinking. And then a year later, I got suspended from school again for being drunk because I could not learn, you know. Every time I would go to these events or take alcohol with me to school and think to myself or tell myself that I was just going to have a couple swigs, you know, that I just was going to have a little bit just to take the edge off just so I could be around people. But the thing with me, because I'm an alcoholic, is I put a few in me and I just can't stop. I get thirstier. And I would end up blacking out, passing out, and getting caught. You know, so again, I got suspended. We were on this school trip down here. I was in Baltimore, and my family had to drive down and pick me up. I got suspended from school. I wasn't allowed I mean, a huge deal. I was violent and belligerent, which made it worse. And again, this time it was something inside me had shifted, you know. And I call this point, the reason why I tell this story is it's my first moment of clarity. And what happened was that morning after, my mom called me down to the kitchen, and she was hysterical. You know, I mean, she was just, and if you're an alcoholic of my type, I mean, you've broken many people's hearts many times over. And it was the first time that I'd really hurt her. And I remember the face, the look of her face about the disgust, you know, where she didn't look like, I didn't know whether she was going to smack me across the face or hug me. You know, and she took me by the shoulders and she started shaking me and crying and saying, you know, do you need help? Do you need help? Just tell me what you need and I will give it to you. And I started crying, you know, because I didn't mean to hurt anybody. You know, I was just trying to have a good time. You know, the only thing is that I'm so selfish and self-centered that, you know, my feelings, I mean, just come before anyone else's. And I remember feeling scared, feeling like, what am I doing? You know, why am I living this way? And I don't want to hurt her, you know. So that day, I made my first solemn vow, you know. I'm going to change, I'm going to turn things around. I mean, I called up my dealers and you know, said that I was done. We locked up all the alcohol in the house in a closet, you know, lock and key. I threw out everything that I had, all my paraphernalia, everything. You know, I was serious. And everybody in school was happy and proud of me. You know, I was getting, like, high fives in the hallway. And I did it. For a period of time, I felt better. You know, but 1 week goes by, 2 weeks goes by, and then I start winding up. You know, like, I think it's Clancy who says, I mean, that spring in my gut just starts getting bounded. And I start feeling irritated. And I start feeling like life is getting more and more unbearable. And I don't even know why. I don't even have an excuse or something to point at and say, that's why I feel crazy. And that makes me crazier. You know, and it gets to the point where one Saturday night, I would come into a house party, and I just pick up a drink and I drink it. You know, no second thoughts. You know, and that was described to me as, you know, the kind of second aspect of what of my illness. You know, I have this peculiar mental twist where I can't remember, you know, the pain of my last drunk. I can't remember the remorse, my resolve, you know, and I just forget. I forget why I stopped in the first place. And my physical state, I mean, I'm so restless, irritable, and discontent, is I need release. And I know alcohol gives that to me. So I went into this party and I just drank, you know, and it was no big deal. I just progressed, and I mean, this is a progressive deal. I just picked up harder things and ended up in worse situations. And I could tell you that I had many, many, many morning afters where I felt disgusted with myself, where I was horrified about the things that happened to me the night before, the things that I did, the people that I hurt, the things that I lost. But it was never enough. You know, if love could keep me sober, if remorse and guilt could keep me sober, I would have got sober a long time ago. You know, but I cannot remember. I can't retain that memory. And what happened was that a couple months later, my mom suddenly passed away from a brain aneurysm. And it was very sudden, and it was, I was horrified. You know, I mean, I remember going to the hospital and feeling, I mean, so disgusted with myself, so ashamed that I couldn't even turn it around and be a good daughter for her before she passed. And I swore up and down to God. This time I didn't tell anyone. It was just between me and God. And I said, I swear to God, for her memory, you know, I'm going to change. I'm going to make things different. And again, 1 week goes by, 2 weeks goes by, and I drink again. You know, in the next 4 years of my drinking, when I was still up in New Jersey, I was like a tornado that blew through people's lives. You know, I would move from social group to social group. I mean, and I knew that there was something very wrong with me. I was sent to therapy, to priests. I went to Jesus camp. I mean, I was definitely trying to be saved in some way. You know, I would do anything. I read books and listened to tapes and CDs. I mean, I had my palms read and tried to get like aura washes, you know what I mean? Like, I just knew that there was something very dark and no one understood. You know, any person that would try to talk to me about my drink or talk to me about the way that I was living, I just get angry. I just completely shut down. You know, and the truth was, and I could give people some excuses or some, you know, validations why I was, you know, and especially now that my mom had passed, I had a reason, you know, but the truth was deep down inside, I didn't know. That I didn't know, you know, I didn't know why I was living this way. And I thought New Jersey was a problem. I thought my family baggage, I thought my SOB of a father was, I moved, you know. I packed my stuff up. I applied to my number one university, and I moved down here to D.C. And what happened was, is the same exact thing that was happening in New Jersey. You know, as soon as I landed in Reagan International Airport, I was surrounded by all the wrong people, and we were ready to do all the same things that I've been doing. And I remember that night waking up in some, you know, sketchy, dirty apartment, and catching a glimpse of myself in the mirror and saying, how did I get here? You know, I remember pounding my fist and saying, how did this happen again? And then I would just drink to oblivion so I would forget and didn't have to worry. And my first introduction to AA was Absolute Chance, you know. Or not even chance, I have to call it grace, because I knew it was the grace of God, is what happened was, at this point I was picking up harder substances and partying with all the wrong people, and one night I blacked out an apartment complex on the roof, and that was the last thing I remember. I remember drinking on the roof of this apartment in D.C. and blacking out. You know, I don't know what happened that night, but the very next morning I woke up and I was in this girl's apartment. And like I said, I'm used to waking up in strange places, you know, in horrifying situations. But this time it was different. You know, I woke up and I was fully clothed and I was wrapped up in a blanket. And I woke up, I came to, and I was scared. I didn't know where I was. And, you know, I seemed to be fine. And this girl approached me. She was probably, I don't know, 20, 22 at the time. And I was like, oh, here we go. You know, what, she's going to start attacking me, yelling at me, you know. Asked me questions, and she handed me a glass of water, and she just started talking about herself. And I mean, I was confused. I mean, all my life, everyone's been trying to talk to me about me. And this girl sat down, and she started telling me some drunk stories about how hard she used to party and how she used to run around D.C. naked. I mean, crazy stories. And I caught myself shaking my head, nodding, laughing. You know, and she started saying things like, don't you ever feel like there's a committee inside your head and they won't shut up until you put some down in you? And I couldn't believe that. You know, all my life I've been trying to describe these voices in my head and people thought I was schizophrenic, you know? And this girl, she was saying things that I didn't even realize I felt until she said it, you know? And that day, it was described to me as that's the language of the heart. You know, it's one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. And we had probably 15 minutes we had that conversation, and she had me. I felt faith in her. I felt like this girl understands. You know, she told me she had been sober in AA for a couple of months and asked me if I wanted to come to a meeting with her. And people have been, I mean, I got my first AA pamphlets when I was in seventh grade, when I saw the substance abuse counselor. And no one's ever been able to get me to go. You know, but I went with her willingly, and we were going to meetings all over D.C., but the problem with me, you know, has been the problem all my life, is that I'm an egomaniac. You know, I walked into these meetings and just completely related out. I just judged everyone. You know, I just felt like I'm too young, too smart, too, you know, rich, I'm too everything, you know, for this. I looked on the wall, and I saw the word powerless. And I laughed. I said, are you kidding me? How could you be powerless over liquid? You know, are these people retarded? You know, I felt like, you know, you have no idea where I've come from, you know, what kind of life I've had to live, what I've had to walk through. There's nothing powerless about me. I can do anything I put my mind to. You know, I really felt that way. And I saw the word God, and that made me even angrier. You know, I was raised Roman Catholic, and like I said, I went to church every Sunday. I mean, new chapters from the Bible and verses, and, you know, I felt insulted. I mean, you people can't teach me more about religion than I already know. You know, and I had a lot of resentment. I felt, what kind of God takes a child's mother away? What kind of God puts this kind of father in a girl's life? You know, and I was like, this isn't for me. You know, and very politely, I came around for a little bit, and said, no, I'm going to try my way. You know, I can do this, and that's been the greatest obsession of my life, is how to control and enjoy my drinking. You know, and I've tried switching brands in the past. I've tried counting. I've tried having stipulations like only by myself or only with people or only on weekdays or only Monday, Wednesday, Friday. You know, I mean, I would always have these combinations, you know, if I could mix in the right substance, maybe that would regulate my drinking. And it was always to no avail. And this last time I thought that, you know, doing other substances only and not drinking would work. And that lasted only a couple of weeks before I was back to the booze, you know. And the last 8 months of my drinking were horrifying. You know, anything remotely social, remotely glamorous about my drinking, even remotely delusional about my drinking, and it ended. I was fully aware of the insanity that I was living, and I could not drink enough to blot it away. And I couldn't even put up the front of wanting to go out or be around people. You know, I locked my door. It was me and my bottles and my drugs, and that was it. You know, and there were maybe once or two failed attempts where I would try to get fully dressed and put on lots of jewelry and look like my life was together, and I would, like, never make it out of the room. I'd just be fully dressed in, like, a dress in my room, you know, drinking by myself. And what I know is that, I mean, that's my hell. You know, when I think back, when life gets hard today, I look back to that time and think to myself that I never want to go back to that hell. Because it was just like the living dead, you know, where I felt like I wanted to die and didn't have the courage to even kill myself, which made me even more disgusted with myself. And I prayed to God. I mean, I wouldn't pray to God. I cursed God and just asked if I could just, you know, nod out and not wake up. You know, if I could just choke on my vomit. It was like, I mean, it was horrifying. And a friend of mine describes it like an animal on the side of the road waiting to die. You know, I just wanted some sort of mercy killing. You where I would just have to not deal with anything, you know, where I would need booze to fall asleep at night. I'd wake up because I needed more booze, and I would rearrange where I hid it because I had this constant fear that I was running out or someone was going to take it away. And when I woke up in the morning, I was horrified of life, so I needed to drink or use again. And that was that last 8 months. And once again, the grace of God intervened. I went back home to Jersey because my dad gave me a call. He had gotten a woman pregnant, and we were getting married. And if you're anything like me, you don't want to touch anything. You don't like to touch emotions with a 10-foot pole. You know what I mean? Like, I just want to seem like I'm fine. Things are great. I'm fine with this. You know, but I wasn't. But what I do is I said to myself, well, I'm just going to drink a little bit. I'm going to go to this wedding, and I'm just going to have a few social drinks just to get the edge off, you know. And I went to my father's wedding, and it was open bar. I mean, you can't turn down a drink from an open bar. So like any good alcoholic, I mean, I went there, and I said, I mean, I had great intentions. There was probably 300 family and close relatives, and I knew I could not make a fool of myself. This was not that kind of event. And I went to that open bar and asked for a Jack and Coke, you know. And I sat back down, drank that Jack and Coke. Like almost every other time that I drank, I experienced the phenomenon of craving. And I went back up to that bar and I said, two Jack and Cokes, you know. So it's not noticeable that I'm walking back and forth, right? I'll just have one and then nurse one at the table. And then that dance became Jack and Ice, because maybe the Cokes were just diluting it too much, you know, and that Jack and Ice turned into just Jack, you know, and I did that dance, you know, until I blacked out, passed out, fell down drunk. And I don't remember what kind of humiliating acts I did that night, because like most nights that I drank, I don't remember, you know, but my loved ones do. And I woke up the next morning to the same angry, sorry, attacking phone calls that I had many times over. You know, I woke up the next morning and my dad, my aunts, my dad's sisters were calling me and cursing at me and yelling and, you know, what's wrong with you? You know, what? And something inside me had shifted. You know, like I said, I mean, I've heard that. I've heard that, and I know what lip service to give them back. But something inside me just felt so sick and tired that I couldn't even feed them the same BS line that I had all my life. Some part of me is just tired of fighting, you know, tired of pretending. And I just listened. I just listened and agreed. And that I mean, I did not run into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that night, or the day after even. You know, I didn't drink that or use that day, which was Sunday. And Monday morning, I woke up and I was going through withdrawal because I didn't realize that I was hooked on the substances that I'd been using. And, I mean, I was horrified. I didn't realize I was going through withdrawal. I thought I was physically dying. You know, I called up friends and we were describing, and then I was physically carried to my first meeting in Southeast D.C. And if, I don't know if you know D.C., but Southeast is not not anything that I would outwardly relate to. You know, but I went into that room, and women there coddled me and cradled me and told me how to work through it physically. And I felt like, well, that's it. I just got to get over these physical, this physical thing that I'm going through. And then after that, you know, I'm just not going to drink. I'll be fine. You know, I just want to get through this physical stuff. And I felt like, fine. But again, I mean, the series of events that happened from my last drink to today, I know that I'm in the palm of God's hands. You know, because what happened the following day, after that meeting, I was locked up in my room going through withdrawal, and I get this knock on the door. And at this point, no one knows what's going on with me, you know, but this girl knocks on my door, and she lives downstairs from me. And she says, hey, I heard that you went to AA a couple of months ago. I want to get sober. Can you take me to a meeting? You know, and I felt like, I know that there is a higher power looking after me because that's impossible. And I did. We caught the last 15 minutes of a meeting downtown, and something inside me broke. I walked into that meeting, and like now, how I feel when I walk into any meeting, I feel at home. You know, and some part of me just broke, and I started crying because I felt like, take care of me. You know what I mean? I just felt like this was the last house on the block, and this is all I got. And thankfully, two people from my home group, from my home group were at that meeting. And they obviously could see we were new. I mean, we're shaking and crying and screaming, and literally screaming. And, I mean, they got on their phones and called, I mean, women from Alcoholics Anonymous. And they just said, all right, this girl's going to pick you up tomorrow, and this other girl's going to pick you up the following day, and this girl's going to pick you up this day, and we have our home group meeting on Sunday. I mean, they didn't ask us, really. I mean, they were just giving us, they were just filling up our schedule. And thankfully, at that point, I mean, I was just such a mess, I couldn't say no. And the truth was, though, I didn't go to meetings for the first week. I would send my friend and her roommate to the meetings, and every day we were disgusting. I mean, we weren't showering; we were a mess, you know. But these girls, they would get ready for the meeting, they'd shower and get dressed and all cleaned up, and we were miserable and suicidal all day. But they would come back from the meeting, and there was something about them that had changed. And they were just so excited. You know, like, you got to see this group. You got to see, I mean, there are people like, all right, sober. And we can do this. I don't want to drink anymore. And they were just so enthusiastic. I couldn't believe it. I said, what is this about? You know, I've been to these meetings. They're not all that. You know, and finally, they finally got me to come to a meeting. And it was my home group meeting at Sunday night. And at that point, we were still at 22nd and P in Washington, D.C., and we got to that meeting like an hour early, which was bizarre to me. I felt like, why are we going to this meeting an hour early? But we went in, and it was just like it felt like a mosh pit of people, you know. And I was very intimidated, but I would never show that, so I just came off as very angry. And because if you're a miserable person, happy people make you very angry. And I went into that meeting, and I was disgusted, you know. I mean, people were, like, hugging and laughing, and, I mean, I just, like, swarms of people, you know. And I got all these women running up to me, like, what's your name? Who's your sponsor? What's your sobriety date? And I had no idea what they were talking about, you know. And I sat through that meeting, and I honestly don't remember hearing anything. But I remember how I felt. I remember what you people made me feel like, where I felt like maybe this could work, you know. And I knew, even though I put up this front, like I didn't care, I was disinterested, or I was tough, inside I really wanted what you had, you know. And I remember hearing this insane laughter, you know. And this guy who's my sponsor today was telling a story, and it's humiliating stories of childhood, and people were just hysterically laughing, I mean, knee slapping. And I was like, why are they doing that? I mean, that's horrible. They're laughing at him, you know? And I didn't realize that. I mean, it's just that language of the heart, that the people laugh because they identify. And I wish I could say even from that point that the rest of my sobriety was, you know, peaches and cream, and I went through the steps and magical sober dust was sprinkled on me. But that was definitely not my case, you know. I had the semester was over, so I had to go back up to New Jersey. I had a job lined up in New York City, and I felt like, I mean, this was like a big deal job to me. It was on Wall Street. It fed my ego. I felt like there's no way I'm going to turn this job down and stay down here and do AA with you people, you know. And so I moved back up there, and for the next 2 months, I mean, I experienced untreated alcoholism. And I became truly convinced that I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. Because what happened was I didn't work any steps. I talked to my sponsor by name, but I really didn't ask for help or direction or anything, really. And I felt as insane as I felt those last months drinking. Yet there wasn't a drop of anything in me. Where I felt I understood what people talked about compulsion. Because my body was dying for a drink, I wanted to die. You know what I mean? I just could not. I was like, I'm gonna kill myself or I'm gonna drink. Every day that was the battle that was going through my head. Kill yourself, drink. Kill yourself, drink. And I was getting angrier and angrier at AA because all I heard was go to meetings. You know, and coming to meetings is good, but I mean, there's definitely a program to be worked, and I know that from my experience because I went to maybe almost sometimes 3 times a day. You know, I went to 3 meetings a day at sometimes, on most days 2 meetings a day. And I was just insane. I walked in a meeting, feel insane, cry and scream and yell, and not ask for help, or actually people tried to help me and I would reject it, and I would go back home and wonder, or leave the meeting and wonder why my car was driving towards the liquor store. You know, or my car was steering towards the wrong side of town. And thank God at that point, the sponsor I have today, for some reason started calling me. And for some reason, I could hear him. And I'm telling you that I was so close. I mean, there were so many nights where I was pacing my kitchen floor with a butcher knife in one hand and poured Jack Daniels on the other. I said, something's going to happen. You know, and that night, my sponsor would call that moment, you know. And again, I know that I have a higher power that works in my life, because that's impossible. And for some reason, my sponsor's voice was louder than my head, where I could feel so insane and so loud. And for some reason, when I would pick up the phone and ask for help, I could hear the directions. And it didn't make sense, you know. Every part of me was like, "That's." I would call and be like, "I'm crazy. I want to die." And then my sponsor would say, "Well, how have you been of service today?" like that. Just, you know what I mean? It was like we're speaking different languages, you know. And it's like we're, you know, who have you helped? You know, it was just like trick questions. Like I was like, "Do you not hear what I'm saying? I want to drink." And I was always reverted back to the book. Always, you know, read this page, say this prayer. And I needed that. And I thank God for that kind of sponsorship where I had somebody who understood what I was going through and led me out of the woods. And it felt like every time that it was like I was needed to be walked off the ledge, you know, because I experienced compulsions for the first couple of months of my sobriety. You know, I don't know if it was that I fully surrendered, but some part of me was still fighting and wanted to drink. And I thank God that the flow of AA or the home group and the AA that I found in New Jersey was just such a strong current that all I had to do was jump in and try to stay in the middle, and I would be carried. And that was definitely my experience. And another thing about my early sobriety was that I could not sleep. You know, I was bombarded with memories and nightmares and day terrors of things that I did, things that happened to me. I mean, I knew what I was drinking to cover up. And I felt like I needed to be institutionalized. I actually, in early sobriety, called up a psych ward and tried to check myself in, and it wouldn't take me, thank God. And my sponsor started walking me through the fourth and fifth step, you know, the fourth step. And I mean, my fourth step was very long. I mean, I thought that when people would share about resentment, and we talked about resentment, I was like, I'm not an angry person. Like, I'm a nice person. I'm someone who gets along with everyone. And I wrote out my 4-step, and it took, I think, like 6 hours to read. You know, I had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of resentments. I think everyone that came in contact with me, I resented. You know, because I had this problem with me where I feel like I had this script that I want people to perform to or act abide, and they don't act abide, so I resent them. You know, I have these roles that I assign to people, and they don't even know that they've been assigned this role in my life. So when they don't fulfill it, I resent them. And my experience was when I read that 5th step, that night I fell asleep. And I mean, I've had a few sleepless nights, but for the most part, I've been able to put my head on a pillow and fall asleep. And I'm grateful for that, you know, because when I got sober, that was all I wanted. I told my sponsor, I was like, all I want to do is stop crying and be able to fall asleep at night, you know. And I had definitely been overpaid. And 6 and 7 at first just totally went over my head. It was like 2 paragraphs in the big book. Didn't understand it. I was like, I said the prayer, checked the box, and then I wrote out my 8th step. And for me, this is where major gifts of my sobriety had occurred is steps 8 and 9, where I feel like a truly different person because of it. Like I said, my mother passed away. I mean, I couldn't even say mom. You know, I couldn't, during Mother's Day, I would just drink myself to oblivion. I mean, it was just too painful to deal with. And my sponsor had me talk to this gentleman out in California, and who I had never met, never heard of. I just heard his speaker CD. It was Charlie C. From California. And I heard his speaker CD, and I said, I can't believe that. He has my experience. And my sponsor said, why don't you call him? I said, what? I said, you can't just call up. These people are on CDs. They're like big deals. Little did I know that literally anybody can be recorded and put on CD. But I mean, Charlie C., I called up Charlie C., and it was unbelievable. He was a good AA member that picked up his phone when somebody needed help and didn't, like, brush me off or give me the impression like he was too busy. I mean, he really gave me his time and attention, and he gave me specific directions of what to do. I went up to my mother's grave, and some people did letters, but what I did, I actually talked to my mom like she was there. And I left that day feeling nothing, you know. I drove away, like waiting for some white light, maybe a breakdown, and I felt nothing. You know, I was kind of angry. I said, this doesn't work, you know. But a couple of months later, when Mother's Day came around, I woke up and I was fine, and all of a sudden, I broke down crying. And I said, see, this doesn't work. You know, they lied. Look at this. I'm still crazy. I called my sponsor. My sponsor told me to call Charlie. So I called Charlie out in California. And I forgot about the time difference. I actually called him at, like, probably 6, 7 a.m. their time. And he still willingly picked up the phone and gave me his time and attention. He said, what's wrong? And I said, you know, look, I'm hysterical. Like, this is painful. It didn't work. Maybe I didn't do it right. And he said, well, why are you crying? I was like, I don't know. I love her, you know. I miss her. And then he said, well, isn't that strange? He's like, can you even say that you've ever felt that way before? You know, isn't it true that the last times that you've cried over your mother, it was because of you, right? About you and how you felt and what you did about you as a daughter. And this is the first time that you're crying for her. And it was like, you know, a light bulb. And I couldn't believe it. And that has definitely been, I have many, many experiences like that. I have little white light experiences or, you know, burning bush or even cool bruises or anything like that, but I have many experiences of amends that in hindsight I can see that something inside me is shifting around. And then my sponsor describes me is that's why I'm in AA. You know, it's because my insides need to be rewired. You know, I have broken insides and I need huge arrangements and displacements of my ideas and emotions, and these steps do that. You know, and another powerful amends was I was a terrible, terrible bully in school, you know. I mean, because like I said, I was awkward for my early years, so I felt like I just need to pay people back, I guess, or I'm such an insecure person that I felt like if I put other people down, I would feel better about myself. And I mean, I was a terror. And there were many, many girls on my 8th step that I felt like there's no way that these people want to see me again. And then my sponsor agreed and said, well, why don't you write a letter? And I said, a letter? You know, how do I know they're even going to get it? I don't even know where these people are. And I tracked down some of these girls, and I wrote a letter. And I didn't hear anything, again, for months, heard nothing. And but I went up to Jersey one time to and saw a movie with my cousin. We were at the movie theater, and one of these girls was there. And we caught eyes like we were away. I mean, she's probably back of that wall. It's not even further, but we caught eyes. And I didn't know whether I should run away or hide or just pretend I didn't see her. And then something, and she walked over to me. I still didn't know what was happening. I was like, well, I don't know. I guess stay the course, you know. And she just embraced me. She hugged me and she cried and she said, you know, you don't know how much you hurt me in the past, but I'm so happy that you're doing well. And I'm so happy you even realized that you were doing that to me. And again, you know, and it was weird because after a series of those, making those amends, I started to be able to really talk to women. You know, I could not talk to any woman. You know, I felt I had a deep hate, you know, and after that, I started getting these women that wanted me to sponsor them, you know, which was like impossible because sponsorship, I mean, it's like an intimate relationship. I was incapable of that. And all of a sudden, I felt like I could truly care about other women. You know, and another big thing was my father, you know, who I blamed and went to therapy because of my hate for that and the things that happened to me as a child. I mean, any court of law, any therapist would have said this is a toxic relationship. The two of you should just sever ties and never, ever, you know, come in contact. You know, for the first couple years of my sobriety, I mean, I had a deep found resentment. I mean, insane, you know, crying in fetal position because I hated him so much and I was so unwilling to make amends because I felt like he had wronged me. You know, how could I make amends for a man that did these things to me? And my sponsor, thank God, and women in my group who had exact experiences. You know, nobody was just guessing or anything. People gave me their exact experiences. And it was a slow process. You know, we were incapable of being around in close proximity or even having civil phone calls. You know, so again, my sponsor told me to send him Hallmark cards. I said, are you kidding me? I mean, he's going to set this on fire. Like, this is crazy. You know, this is cheesy and stupid and a waste of time. But, like, you know, thank God I grew up in AA with the ethic, you know, go against yourself. Do things that you don't believe, that you don't like, because it's probably the best thing for you. And I did it. You know, I set up those cards religiously. And I would tell him what was going on in my life, and I would begrudgingly write, I love you, even though no fiber of my being believed it. And eventually I was able to go up there, like almost like visitation rites. You know, I would have a team of AA members with me to make sure that I acted right and I didn't, you know, worsen the situation. And my father ended up having other children, you know, new babies, and I would show up more and more. And then it felt like the wall that I had built up, it was just being taken down brick by brick. You know, like the thorns in my heart were just being plucked. And I felt like less and less resistant going up there. I mean, it was to the point early on, I mean, we would cross over the Delaware Bridge and I would start freaking out. You know, I'd start crying, almost like wanting to jump off because I felt so afraid, so hurt, just so filled with negative emotion. And thank God my sponsor just taught me to keep showing up. You know, practice these principles. You know, try to live the traditions in the home. And I did, you know, and thankfully, I mean, a year ago, I was able to make direct amends to my father. And it honestly feels like there is nothing between the two of us. And I'm telling you, that is impossible. You know, I wanted to be sent away. I asked my sponsor to send me to this therapeutic week-long camp because I felt like I needed this stuff processed out. But for me, the steps worked. You know, for me, it was like, and I do. I still go up there. I try to go up there once or twice a month and spend the weekend with him and his family. And it's no longer his family. It honestly feels like our family. You know, and I'm grateful for that because if it was up to me, I would have just. It was like. Almost like a broken hand that I just wanted to cut off my arm, you know, to just not deal with it instead of just treating the hand. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful that the people in my home group have consistently wanted more from me than I've wanted for myself. You know, and I'm not somebody who has an easy time getting along with other people. You know, it took me a long time to get used to Midtown because, like, in Jersey, I was like kind of a big fish in a little pond, you know. People were always constantly patting me on the back, telling me how great it was, how young and sober and active. And any new girl that would come around my age, or she was like mine by default, you know. And it was great. It was ego feeding, And but the thing that happened was when I came back down and moved back down to Midtown, I mean, there's like 300 people doing the same thing that you are, and you don't feel so special, you know. And I had major resistance to that, because even sober, even having been taken through the steps for a first time, I mean, my ego finds any crevice that it can sneak into to try to get some sort of gratification. I mean, how sick is it that you want to shine in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, a haven for the sick and suffering? But, I mean, that's where my head goes. And it's been a process being taught how to just be one of many, you know, how to just stay small in AA and just how to be, you know, just being a good chain in the link. And that's been a definitely growing process for me. I mean, I wanted to be president of AA. I wanted to be in charge. I wanted to run all the committees, won all the service positions. And I've needed major ego deflation at depth. And thank God I have a sponsor that does that. You know, it teaches me that if I want to stay sober for very long and be very happy, that, I mean, that is the crux of my problem, is my ego. And it does not need any feeding. You know, so I just try to live by integrity, you know, and do things that people don't see, and try to be of service in that way. And last part is, like, sponsorship has been, I mean, an amazing, amazing part of my sobriety, you know, where I feel it is truly a privilege to work with these women in my life, because it will, not only does it allow me to go through the steps again and keep going through the steps, but more so, I mean, it keeps me accountable when I really don't want to. Because many days, I just don't want to. You know, many days, I feel like I've got mine, and I got to work on my career and get my money, and, you know, and all this outside stuff. And these people remind me, you know, that I got to stay the course. They remind me where I came from. They remind me what I can go back to just like that. You know, very recently, somebody that I sponsored for a year and a half went back out. And it wasn't the first time that somebody I had sponsored for what I considered a period of time went back out. But, I mean, it just really woke me up and made me realize that, I mean, there's no human power. You know, that that I need a connection with a God of my understanding. My sponsor is not going to keep me sober. My home group's not going to keep me sober. Because it's when it's 3 in the morning and I'm crazy, I need something there that's bigger than everything. And it reminds me of that, because I can get confused and kind of almost comfortable in my kind of schedule of AA or my routine and what I need to do. And I'm grateful. I've been kind of blessed, or I don't know, cursed. I was thrilled with the people I sponsor with, divine dissatisfaction, where I feel like I am someone who I've often not felt comfortable in my sobriety despite my actions. But thank God for that, because when I feel that discomfort, I know I need to be seeking more, whether it's through prayer and meditation or working with more people or leaning on more old timers or taking deeper inventories. But it's been kind of like the force that has made me seek and made me want to do more and made me want to ask for more help. And honestly, and that's been a place where I've been at recently. You know, there's been a series of things that haven't gone my way. I mean, since I was a child, I wanted to be a lawyer, and thankfully I graduated college sober, and that was a major gift. I've gotten all these blessings and all these, I mean, sober experiences of traveling in other countries, but like any good old alcoholic, it's just never enough, you know. I always demand more gifts, and it's never right. Even when I get it, I want something different, and that's what happened, you know. I felt like maybe this was the next gift that I should get, was getting into law school, and it's been a tumultuous road of major failures and kind of letdowns, and my ego has not taken lightly to it, you know, because I can go to, well, it's because I'm doing so much AA, you know, well, maybe I should cut back on the AA, or maybe I shouldn't, you know, work. But the truth is that stuff is the thing that keeps me alive, you know, and in my experience, I haven't gotten my way on many things throughout my sobriety, and looking at my own experience, I know that when I don't get my way, it's because God has something better in store for me. And I know that is my experience, but I mean, it's a long, I always hear it, it's the longest distance from the head to the heart, you know. And my head definitely went there. I just recently found out also that my father might have prostate cancer. So, I mean, again, my cage is rattled, you know, but I'm grateful. I'm grateful that every time where I feel kind of unsafe or lacking faith, you know, I'm grateful that I've been a part of a home group and a sponsorship line that has taught me to lean in when things get hard. Not to run away, not to try to fix it, but to try to keep my hands out of it and keep doing, staying busy, staying occupied with the things that kept me sober in the first couple of days. And I need that, you know, and I need opportunities like this that remind me, you know, that there is, it's so clearly evident that there is a loving higher power in my life, and that my higher power didn't bring me all the way, you know, from that first day to this to just drop me on my ass, you know, that I'm still in the same care and protection that I was when I was at a day sober. Even when I was drinking, I know that there was something taking care of me. And I need to be reminded that the people in my sponsor, the people in the rooms, my friends, the old-timers, that they're not trying to deprive me of happiness. They're not trying to, you know, give me a hard time. That these people, even though sometimes harshly, always are pushing me in the right direction. You know, I've always needed to, I like the expression, you know, kind of march to the beat of my sponsor's drum, you know, and sometimes it may be feeling like it's too fast, but I need that, you know, I need a little fire under my ass to make sure that I'm still on this beam, because obviously I'm not a girl that drinks safely, you know, I'm not a girl who drank too much, you know, I truly suffer from a spiritual malady of mind, body, and spirit, and I need a spiritual answer. And for me, the only thing that's ever worked were these steps and working with other alcoholics. And I'm grateful. My life is very full. And thanks for letting me share.